It was a scandal in the 18th century in London that was hushed up at the time because it was so risque. It was an affair between a beautiful young woman named Arabella Fermor, who was a society good time girl, and a very handsome nobleman of the day named Lord Peter. They were real characters. They were real people in London in the 18th century. And basically, against all social propriety and everything that they ought to have been doing, they had a scandalous affair with one another. This in and of itself wasn't so extraordinarily unusual at the time. In fact, it was quite common. But what makes the story interesting is that the famous English poet Alexander Pope found out about this affair between the two people, and he wrote a satirical poem called The Rape of the Lock about it. And although when he wrote the poem he himself was completely unfamous, he was about 23 years old, it made him into the most famous poet in England. So yeah. It's my book is basically a retelling of the story of this whole saga of the of the love affair, and also the poet who takes advantage of it.
It's really a historical novel because that's all the right. facts are right.
Huh? Yeah, they're correct. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And now, one of the amazing things in your book is that, I mean, it's not so much the quality of the book, but the fact of that most of the characters, when this took place, were really very young. Like Alexander Pope was maybe just in his 20s.
Yes, they were all in their 20s,
Annabella
I think.
Annabella Fermor was also very young.
Yes, 20, 22 or 23, and Lord Peter was not much older.
Yeah,
so.
But when you read it, you think, wow, this is the world it's a world I don't know anything of.
Yeah.
Especially because it sounds also adult. It's also well-bred, well-educated.
Yes, that's true.
Full of witticisms.
Yeah.
Things like the youngsters of these days don't do anymore.
No, it's true. I mean, it's strange because, well, I think there are a few things there. One is that, you know, in 300 years ago, people had to grow up a lot more quickly because, well, partly because their life expectancy was a lot shorter. So it would be perfectly normal to have children, you know, in your late teens or early 20s. And people were essentially adults by the time they were, you know, 16 or 17 years old, or at least in terms of their social role, they're adults. But of course, in terms of their sort of psychological and emotional maturity, they weren't, which is part of the problem that the characters in the book encounter. But also, I think, you know, that the witty conversations and the sort of exciting exchanges that the characters have with one another all the time was the style of the day. It was very important for people to sort of show off their wit and their social sophistication in a way that for some reason we don't really do anymore.
Yeah.
Although there have been other periods in history where people have, like, you know, Oscar Wilde and his circle, or Dorothy Parker and her circle in New York. Mm-hmm. In the 20th century, that's all, you know, social milieu where it was very important to display your wit.
Yeah. Another thing is, of course, that, I mean, historically speaking, it's all correct that essays and drinking hot chocolate and going to a cafe was sort of becoming, I mean,
that's right.
Yeah. It happened those days.
Yeah. Well, it was all sort of starting
grow,
then.
Yeah? Yeah. It was all starting then.
Yeah.
And then you, while you're reading it, you think, all right, so this is the very start of all this part of our Western culture.
Exactly.
Which we have completely forgotten that it has grown through the years.
Exactly.
The ages.
Exactly. Yes. If you said to somebody, when did people start going to coffee shops or cafes?
Yeah.
I don't know what you'd say. Probably early 20th century or something. Mm. But that's not right.
It started all then.
It started in the 18th century,
Like also Alexander Pope, he was the very author of the essay on criticism.
Yes.
Which was well lauded in those days.
Exactly.
But it was one of the first essays, I think, that really hit, that got quite popular.
Yes, it's true. And the other characters in my novel who were famous writers of the day are Addison and Steele, who started the journal The Tatler and The Spectator, which of course still exist, and they really came up with the idea of kind of print journalism and the journalistic essay, something like what now would appear in, you know, The New Yorker or the London Review of Books, those kinds of things. That was all starting then too.
So
in terms of publishing history, it's a really interesting period.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And interesting is also that, I mean, within the book, one of the main theme is, I think, keeping face and losing face.
Yes.
And everyone tries to keep face.
Yeah.
And if you lose face, you're done for, I mean, socially
yes.
speaking.
Yes.
And the whole book sort of builds up to the very moment that someone loses face.
Yes.
And cannot handle it.
Yep.
She's utterly gobsmacked.
Yeah.
And if she could have said something, like something very witty,
yeah.
she wouldn't have lost face so dramatically.
That's exactly right.
And this is something I think we've lost, mm-hmm. I find,
mm-hmm.
here in Belgium, maybe wherever
no,
in Europe.
No, in New York as well, which is where
yeah.
I live. Yes.
So it's something you can still find in other cultures. Like in Japan, it's still very important that you don't lose face.
Yes, I suppose you're right.
In certain circles.
Yeah.
Maybe, I mean, the upper class... The English upper class people,
yes,
maybe still
to some extent, yes,
true, yeah.
yes.
But I think we've outgrown that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, it's really interesting. I mean, I suppose one of the peculiarities of the 18th century, again, that we forget, is that you know the Romantic movement hadn't happened yet, so the whole emphasis in Western history on you know one's interior self, on the way you really feel and really think, and that being more important than your exterior self. Which is essentially the sort of psychological innovation of Romanticism. Mm-hmm. That hasn't happened yet. So so the surface and the social surface is where everything takes place and where it's important to kind of preserve your impression of what kind of a person you are. And so, yes, exactly. If you lose face at a public level, at a social level, it's as though you've lost your character almost.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's really changed. Romanticism is not the only thing that happened, but that was the first of many intellectual movements that places more importance on the psychological interior.
Yeah.
And now I think, you know, it's okay to be shy or foolish even in public.
Yeah.
Yeah, because the assumption is there's much more to it than that.
Yeah.
yeah.
One of the most striking things in the book is that you're confronted with this with those people who play a social role,
yeah,
and they actually do play a role because they're not really themselves.
It's exactly
there's always
right.
this, even you say it in your own words, sort
yeah.
of that ironical distance.
Yes,
there's
yes.
always not really the stiff upper lip yet, but
yep.
there's always this distance between who they actually maybe are,
yeah,
and how they show themselves, I mean, publicly.
Yes, it's true, or perhaps I mean. It's a complicated and interesting idea, I think, whether there's a difference between who people really are and how they show themselves, or perhaps even, you know, social theorists of the day would have gone so far as to say that the way you show yourself is the way you are. Mm. And that's why public humiliation is tantamount to sort of disappearing altogether as an individual.
Yeah.
And it's to us, it's such a foreign idea that superficial things are more important than deep interior things. But I think to some extent it was true then.
Yeah.
Yeah. And as a fiction writer, that was extremely difficult for me because I was reading the letters and the diaries and the, you know, sort of public records of these famous figures like Alexander Pope and Jonathan Swift and Addison and Steele and the female characters. And, of course, their own letters, their own diaries aren't particularly intimate. They're quite public and quite mannered. And so it's really hard to get a sense of what they were like inside their own heads. So as a writer, that's where I had to fill in the gaps and give it back to a modern audience in a way that is more comprehensible for us.
Yeah. And the other thing that struck me was that socially speaking, the rule of the one-upism is all there.
Yeah, absolutely. If you couldn't come up with a clever response, then forget it.
Yeah,
go
and
home.
That reminded me a bit of the late hip-hop culture.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Right, I like that.
You can diss someone and
then
the other one has to come up with something better.
Yeah, I like that a lot. I haven't made the connection between my
kind
novel
of verbal,
and hip-hop.
It's verbose, it tells about verbosity, being very witty as well.
Mm-hmm.
So that struck me. But
You're right. And also just the power of words, which again, I think
now,
to some extent we've lost, probably because we're a very visual culture because of like TV and film and so on.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, the idea that language has more power than anything else is an idea we don't really pay much attention to now.
Yeah. And I think at the end of the novel, when Arabella cannot say anything more, she's utterly speechless.
Yes.
then she loses it.
That's
if
right.
If you're speechless, you just lose it.
Then that's the end. Yeah.
Yeah,
it's true. Mm-hmm. Very good. That's a good way of putting it.
And another thing that is also historical true, that in those days you had a sort of semi-apartheid between the Catholics and the Protestants.
Exactly.
And that was quite crude because it was like a full-blown segregation.
Yeah.
The Catholics had to live at least 10 miles outside London.
Yep.
And couldn't really get in.
It's true. I mean, in the modern world, obviously, we're very familiar with religious conflict. We're thinking about it all the time. But they tend to be either international conflicts, like, you know, the Islamic world against the Judeo-Christian world, or, you know, something on that scale. Or we think about very intense national conflicts. For example, in Northern Ireland. But we've forgotten that England itself, which to us seems such a stable and rather boring country, religiously speaking, was embroiled in this, you know, violent, almost civil war between the Catholics and the Protestants from the 16th century through to the 18th century.
Yeah.
And the Catholics, who, before the Reformation in England, were of course the most powerful families, had the vast majority of the wealth, and had immense political and religious power, 200 years later in the 18th century had been reduced to a tiny minority, and most of their money had been stripped away from them, both through legislature and also through persecution.
Yeah. Yeah, it reminded me a bit of some rules or legislation that was... I mean, it didn't come to be.
Yeah.
But there was a politician in Rotterdam. He said, well, maybe all the new people arriving in the Netherlands.
Yes.
They should just live outside Rotterdam.
Yes, that's right. I remember
and that,
that
was,
yeah.
I think, about 5-6 years ago.
Yeah.
So when you read it, you think, wow, this is too wild.
Yeah.
That must have been really the 18th century. But then you just find that things can just return and come back in a different way.
It's
but basically
very true.
It's the same thing.
Yeah, I was noticing actually just from being in Europe at the moment, you know, you hear about, when you're in America and so on, you hear about the rise of the right-wing nationalist groups in Europe, and you sort of think, oh, it doesn't make a huge amount of sense, because I think of Europe as being very liberal.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're here, you realise that there's this dense concentration of people and cultures and languages and political viewpoints, and it's so geographically concentrated that it makes conflict just escalate very quickly. And I think probably in England or in London in the late 17th century, when the 10 Mile Act happened and the Catholics weren't allowed to live in the centre, it was probably a similar atmosphere.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the other thing was that I find is something we have also outgrown, but in the past you could have a mistress.
Yeah.
Like Arabella is Lord Peter's mistress.
Mistress, yeah.
It's sort of a public secret.
Yes.
Some people know it.
Yes.
People tend to hush it.
Exactly.
They have sex.
Yeah.
Yeah. Everyone assumes so.
Yeah.
Or thinks maybe something's going
on.
Yeah. But the whole point is that if she wants to get married,
yeah,
she should be unspoiled.
That's right.
Like still a virgin.
Exactly.
And this is something we don't have anymore in the Western culture.
No,
but
it's
again,
true.
It's sort of slightly imported back again by the Muslim people,
yeah,
and people of Islamic origins.
Yeah.
They just still tend to do that or to believe in this. But of course, there are lots of women who want to outgrow that as well.
Yeah, it's
but
true.
But it's something that was about 300 years old here in Europe.
Yeah. Well, you know, normally when people hear that I've written a book set in the 18th century, they think it's going to be like, you know, a TV adaptation of a Jane Austen novel, very, very prim and proper and chaste and so on. And, you know, that's kind of, television has made us think that that's what the past was like.
Yeah.
But in fact, in up until about the mid-18th century in England, there was a great deal of sexual freedom, both for men and women. And I think that comes as a big surprise. As you say, people had mistresses, not just men, but you know, respectable women would be someone's mistress even before they were married.
Yeah.
And of course, it couldn't be publicly spoken about because the fiction was that you were supposed to be chaste and virginal when you were married. But in practice, you know, people carried on all the time. And when I was writing the book, it made me think a great deal about kind of the vulnerability of women back then. Both, you know, on the one hand, they had a lot of freedom because they could take lovers and so on. But on the other hand...
It's only when they were married.
Yes, yes, yes. Or if they did before they were married, it had to be kept very quiet, and it was a difficult negotiation. But obviously, you know, women then weren't able to work, and there was no birth control or anything. So it was an extremely vulnerable position.
Yeah.
And we think now that like women's lives have changed completely and that it's no longer like that. But as you say, in a number of cultures, women still feel themselves to be, you know, in an extraordinarily precarious position.
Yeah, because the best position would have been to get married to someone who's really very rich.
Yeah.
And
for them
who's
to
abroad
die.
A lot.
And who's what?
Abroad a lot.
Yeah, no, yeah. Perfect.
That would
yes.
be perfect.
Yes, yes.
Like you've got a very luxurious life.
Yeah.
And you could have your own boyfriends.
But you don't really have to deal with them. Yeah. Yeah. Or even better, perhaps to marry young to someone very wealthy who then dies, leaving you a widow with a lot of money. And then you really are perfectly free to do whatever you want.
Yeah.
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 So actually, in the fiction of the 18th century, the most... alluring women are often young, wealthy widows because they have their own houses and their own fortunes and complete freedom.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And in your epilogue, I'm not sure whether it's the right word, but you describe who the real characters were.
Mm.
And then one of the first things that struck me was that Lord Peter
died
about 3 years later because of
smallpox.
Smallpox.
Yeah.
And I thought, all right.
Divine justice.
Yeah. No. I mean, that's the reality then. Oh,
yeah.
That was the reality then.
Yeah, yeah.
Something you cannot, I mean, it can't happen anymore here.
It's true. It's true. I suppose people tend not to die suddenly anymore.
Yeah. And there was also this semi-liberated woman. I lost her name now.
Oh, Mary Watley Montagu.
Indeed.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
She travelled a lot, went to Greece and Italy.
Yes,
and she stayed there.
Turkey, and introduced the smallpox vaccine into England.
Yeah, indeed.
Yeah, which is pretty amazing.
Yeah, for that century.
Actually, she encountered the idea of inoculating against smallpox when she was in Turkey. The Turkish royal family had inoculated their children. She, Mary Watley Montagu, had her children inoculated, and she then persuaded the King of England and his wife to inoculate their children, and that's how it spread.
Oh, right.
It was actually quite a risky procedure because you could get smallpox from it.
Yeah.
But if it worked, then you were safe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And another question is, how much have you been influenced by the literature of then? Because like the book, the title says "The Scandal of the Season."
Yeah,
Alexander Pope's poet poem was the rape of the lock.
Yes,
so the same structure.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah,
well, we did that deliberately. Very much. I mean, the writer who at the time who was extremely influenced by Pope was Jane Austen, because the Rape of the Lock, Pope's most famous poem, is basically a comedy of manners about an elite social world where something goes wrong. And I think this is the same kind of comedy that Jane Austen is telling. And she admired Pope very much and was influenced by him. So when I was writing, I was kind of thinking about how a Jane Austen plot works and how, in some ways, my book was like Jane Austen but with sex because it was 100 years earlier. The other novel of the period that was really important for me was Tom Jones, the Henry Fielding novel, which is very sort of bawdy and funny and... badly behaved, everyone's very badly behaved and does whatever they want. And I love that book. It's great fun.
So did you also find that was an influence in the way you wrote up, like sentences, structures, words?
Yeah, it was. And I tried in a way in my book to sort of give the flavour of what an 18th century novel feels like and sounds like. When I first drafted it, actually, it was almost completely like an 18th century novel, which is to say that I didn't really go into my characters' heads. Everything was happening at the level of the dialogue and on the surface. And then my editor and my agents and all these friends who read it pointed out that, you know, the novel has evolved for 300 years since then. We've figured out how to tell stories much better. So you should adopt some of those techniques.
Yeah.
So I went back and sort of rewrote it. But it was funny experimenting in a form that, you know, has been so outdated, but still has elements that I really like. I mean, the comedy of the 18th century, I think, is very fresh still.
Yeah. And what also struck me was that Alexander Pope is one of the first writers or poets who could actually live off his own writings.
Yes, that's extremely striking. Shakespeare, of course, made some money, but sort of for other reasons, because of the structure of the theatre and his shareholding and so on. But Alexander Pope was the first English poet to make a fortune, a huge amount of money off his writing. Most of his money actually came from his translations of Homer, which was the next major project he undertook after The Rape of the Lock. But, you know, he bought himself an enormous house in Twickenham on the river. He had a very... you know, well-to-do lifestyle. Part of the reason for this actually is that he was also the first writer to protect himself with his own copyright, which before then was not customary.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And another thing that I wondered about was whether Arabella Vermoor was really that stunningly beautiful or not.
Apparently.
Did you see pictures of her, like paintings?
There is a picture, but it's sort of hard to tell. But the real evidence we have. Is this real evidence? Is that all the newspapers and magazines of the time singled her out as the most beautiful girl of the day.
Because often when I see paintings or pictures of way back then of people
women.
Who were like really the biggest beauties of them all, then you go like, they wouldn't stand a chance right now.
Exactly.
They're not pretty at all. I mean, according to our standards.
That's correct. Well, I suppose partly, I was talking to someone else about this the other day, partly because the standard of beauty then was whether you were healthy with nice teeth and good hair and so on, and quite well fed.
White skin.
White skin, exactly. Whereas now, I think, because health is taken much more for granted, we look for other things in beautiful people. But it's true, when you see particularly 17th century and 18th century beauties, you think it doesn't conform to our idea until the end of the century.
Yeah, they could have been as ugly as Paris Hilton is right now.
Yeah, well, she's hideous.
But with the white skin.
Well, bronze.
Bronze.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I think I've asked most questions. The thing is, of course, like, when you read the book, then you really want to read the essay on criticism.
Yes, well...
And you really want to go and read Alexander Pope's poetry.
Yes.
But it's impossible to find in regular...
It's very hard to find, and it's extremely hard to read.
Yeah.
But I'm a university teacher, and part of the reason that I initially had the idea of writing this book is that I wanted to kind of try to give normal people, normal readers, a sense of what a really fun period the 18th century is and why Alexander Pope was such a great poet, because it's hard to recapture that now.
Yeah.
The poetry's, as you say, hard to get and hard to read. So I think I almost did too good a job of that, because people always say then they try to read Alexander Pope and it's still impossible to read.
It all sounds incredibly pompous.
And
very sort of too much wrought up. Not whether that's the right word, but it's almost like too baroque.
Yes, exactly.
Like overkill.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's like 50 Cent going really wild.
I'm very enamored of your hip hop comparison. I'm going to use that.
Yeah. Because sometimes with hip hop like songs, I mean the text, sometimes you think, this is over the top. This is too much.
It's true.
It's too inventive. Too
and the
creative.
Rhymes are too preposterous.
Yeah, indeed.
Same with
And
Pope.
When you read bits of Pope, you go like, oh, right, this is too much. Yeah.
No, totally.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah.
I'm going to steal your idea.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Thank you for talking to me.
Okay, dit was Sophie G. Met de Scandal of the Season, het schandaal van het seizoen. Hier op het andere boek, 2007, op Radio Centraal.